Sairam, and welcome dear listeners to this week's episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth, a show where I invite questions from you listeners and I answer them on the basis of the deep and profound message of our beloved Bhagwan. I'm Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, who meets you every week with a dilemma, a problem, confusion, or a simple question to understand Swami's words better. It's another beautiful Thursday, another episode, and I have another interesting question from a listener to deal with. And I'm sure it's going to give us another opportunity to explore a little deeper into Swami's message. Our teachers in school would always say this, especially when they ask us if we have any doubts in the end of a class, and no one comes up with any doubts or questions. They would say, either you've understood absolutely well, or you have no clue of what was being taught so far. That's when you will have no doubts. And invariably, our silence will be a sign of the latter more than the former. But there's another reason why we would not ask questions. We sometimes think that we have understood well, but we actually haven't. Once we try to apply the theory that has been taught to a problem or a practical situation, well, then suddenly the concept we thought we have understood well till then starts appearing a little mystifying. Same is the case with Swami's message too. It appears very simple. In fact, it is simple too. But as long as we know it only in theory, we feel we have got it clear and straight. When we start applying it in day-to-day life, we figure out the gaps in our understanding. And that is why Swami would keep saying, head in the forest, hands in the society. Because only when we try to move around and work in the society, we tend to dwell deep into the philosophy too. And that is when the wisdom truly becomes our own. And today I have one such question. Let's see how we go about answering this one and what we can learn in general from trying to answer the question. But before that, I'm going to read for you a very beautiful quote. It's a simple and succinct one. And these are the lines of an American writer by name Kurt Vonnegut. I hope I'm pronouncing the name right. Nevertheless, here comes the quote. I quote, be soft. Do not let the world make you hard. Do not let the pain make you hate. Do not let the bitterness steal your sweetness. Take pride that even though the rest of the world may disagree, you still believe it to be a beautiful place. End of quote. Well, isn't that a beautiful quote? I really love that one. And in a way, it supplements what I've been saying before I read that quote. It's easy to be soft as long as the world has been kind to us. If to be soft is what we have to learn, then we must be soft even when the world has treated us roughly, isn't it? Learning to love is the task. If love is rewarded with love, well, it is easy to be loving. Can we remain loving in spite of being inflicted by pain? Only then we can claim to have learned to love. If we are sweet because we receive sweetness in return, if we are kind because people are kind to us, if we are courteous because all people around are decorous, then it's like standing with the help of crutches. Yes, technically we stand, but we don't stand on our own. It is like swimming with floaters. Technically we may be in the water and making movements that suggest that we are swimming, but we are not really swimming. So if we really wish to be good, loving, kind, righteous, we must be all that when the world is not responding with goodness, love, kindness and righteousness. And when the world chooses to show all its ugliness, we can still believe in beauty because the world is only as good as us. And when there is love in the heart, there is beauty in the creation. It is not easy, but that's the whole point. It's a challenge and we must all be up to it. So before we head to the question, dear listeners, permit me to read that quote by Kurt Vonnegut one more time. I quote, be soft. Do not let the world make you hard. Do not let the pain make you hate. Do not let the bitterness steal your sweetness. Take pride that even though the rest of the world may disagree, you still believe the world to be a beautiful place. Let's then head to the question that we have for this week. As I said, it's a very beautiful question. It's about a practical situation. And we always enjoy answering practical situations based on Swami's message here on the show, don't we? So it's a very interesting question. And What makes me more happy is the person who's asking the question has been kind enough to send the question in her own voice. So I'm going to play out the question. She'll introduce herself too. Let's listen to the question and let's see what answer we can come up for this one.
Sai Ram, my name is Deepa. My question is about a vegetarian cooking non-vegetarian food. Does this incur bad karma? My husband likes non-vegetarian food, dislikes Swami and is an atheist, and I am a vegetarian and a devotee of Swami. We have two children, one is a vegetarian and the other one is a vegan. Children do not want to hurt any animals or birds and hence became vegetarians. When I prepare meat or fish for my husband, I chant Sai Ram, Sai Ram, and I cut it and cook it. Eating non-vegetarian food makes my husband happy, so that's the only reason I cook this. If I don't cook, sometimes he gets annoyed as well. I have heard speakers like Dr. Sri Kansola say, even if you don't eat non-vegetarian food but cook non-vegetarian food for your family, that can incur bad karma. Please let me and other listeners of Radio Sai who might be facing a similar situation know what Swami has said about this. Thank you, Brother Prem, for this wonderful program that you host, and really grateful to Swami and all Radio Sai team. Sai Ram.
Thank you, Sister Deepa, for that question. As I said, it's an interesting one, isn't it? She herself is a vegetarian, but she cooks non-vegetarian food for her husband, and the question is, does that accrue bad karma? Is that acceptable? What would Swami say? There are two issues here. Of course, both are interconnected. One, the question of two conflicting dharmas, right? The role that she plays as a wife. And then, of course, what Swami says about being a vegetarian and the virtue of being a vegetarian. And the other is a bigger question of non-violence itself, the virtue of non-violence. In this case, of course, it's put forth in the form that does sin accrue when we don't eat non-vegetarian food ourselves but are in a situation where we have to cook that for others, right? So that's the question. I'll maybe start with the second one first, you know, the bigger question of the virtue of non-violence itself. The Radio Sai Answering Booth show itself started with an episode on veganism, right? The first episode that I did, the first question that I answered was on veganism, and much later, quite recently, I'd also dealt with a question on the extermination of pests at home. Does that count as a sin? Does that count as a bad karma? In the show on veganism, I think we discuss how Swami's instructions that we must be vegetarians, it's multifaceted. There are a lot of reasons why Swami says that, and it's much larger than this one reason of violence toward the animals, though that is a very important point nevertheless. But that's not all why Swami says that we should not eat non-vegetarian food. And the answer on the pests, extermination of pests at home, we came to the conclusion how it's practically not possible to live a life without causing any harm at all to any form of being. And in fact, most of our scriptures which speak about dharma and right actions acknowledge this fact that it's not possible to lead a life without causing any harm at all. Especially when it comes to the role of a householder, being a woman of the house or even the person who is the head of the family. And that is the reason, I think, when it comes to Sanatan Dharma, when it comes to our scriptures, when Swami quotes and with Swami's message is a reminder of, if I could put it that way, non-violence does not have an absolute status. It does not say that at all times doing a violent act is going to be a sin. It does not give the virtue of non-violence an absolute status. The reason is the idea of dharma, the idea of what one has to do at a particular situation, is always much larger than any one virtue, right? That is the reason why non-violence, or in fact any other virtue for that matter, is not given absolute status according to Sanatana Dharma. if your role and responsibilities and your circumstances call for a certain act, you must be prepared to do it, whether it's non-violent or otherwise. That's the approach that Vedanta or Sanatana Dharma has. But especially when it comes to acts that could be harming someone, that could be a form of violence, it goes without saying that we need to be very, very careful of the emotions that are involved. Are we doing that act which could cause harm in any form, verbal or physical? Is it being done out of an emotion of anger, an emotion of vengeance or hatred, or even some form of sadistic pleasure? Once such emotions start getting involved in our actions, it's no more, we can no more say that these are merely my duties, I'm just doing them as my duties. It doesn't count like that. Another episode we spoke about the concept of karma and vikarma. The moment emotions get involved in our action, especially these emotions which are very strong, it could be strong positive emotions or very strong negative emotions, when they get involved, then the karma, the consequences of that particular action become quite deep and quite prolonged. In fact, the essence of what Lord Krishna tells Arjuna, you know, we keep going back to this because it's one of the most profound scriptures when we talk about practical spirituality, right? What the advice that Lord Krishna gives Arjuna on the battlefield, which we refer to as the Bhagavad Gita. If nonviolence was an absolute virtue, Lord Krishna would not have commanded Arjuna to fight, right? Because if nonviolence at any cost, at any situation, in any circumstance is not acceptable, then Lord Krishna would not have commanded Arjuna to take up his bow and go and take part in the battle. Krishna told Arjuna very clearly that, look, you are a warrior and this is your role and this is your moment. The war is in front of you, you're a warrior, you're a kshatriya, and you know, it is your duty to uphold dharma through this war that you're going to fight. So you must fight, right? There is no way of going away from this. In fact, he said, if you refuse to do this duty, that is when you actually accrue bad karma. And he says it's not only by doing action that you get bad karma, even by inaction you get bad karma. And that's what is the essence of what Krishna tells Arjuna. But having said that, I would like to add a disclaimer. It's a very dangerous thing to tell and accept this idea as it is, right? To say, to in any way justify violence is a very, very dangerous thing, right? Because this can be misused, and it is misused heavily in the name of religion. Violence is being perpetrated. We know all of that, and we're going to go into that, right? If someone wishes to sell the idea of violence, they could use this very concept of dharma, right? You know, if it is your role, it's all right, even if you harm another person, because it's very, very dangerous. That is why Swami always says the idea of love and compassion must be the basis of all our deeds. I mean, that should be the spring from where all our actions and deeds primarily spring out of, right? That's what Swami would say. Love and compassion should be the basis of our entire, the way we lead our life itself. One, the reason why love and compassion should be the base of all our actions and thoughts, one is that it'll ensure a certain amount of self-restraint, that even if our role calls for a little bit of violence, I mean, something as simple as you're a teacher in a class and you need to manage the class, which is unruly, or you're a parent who needs to discipline your child, even in such acts, I mean, if your basis of your approach to things is love and compassion, there will be a certain amount of restraint. You might, take up the tool of being strict physically as one of the ways of correcting the person in front of you, but still there will be a certain amount of self-restraint. Right? That's what being loving and being compassionate will do, even if our role calls for a little bit of violence in our action. The second thing is, as Swami has said, and as we have discussed so many times before on this show, the moment our acts are born out of love, moment whatever we say, whatever we do, the choices we make are all born out of love. Swami says that we are closer to our conscience, so we are more likely to do the right thing in the right circumstance. That is why it is always important to have love and compassion as the basis of our character itself. So though the duty should decide our act, violence especially is one thing that has to be adopted very, very carefully. Just because I'm giving that example of what Krishna told Arjuna, it doesn't mean that it's a license to pick up violence at the drop of a hat. That's why they say, you know, to train somebody to be violent, to train somebody to be a terrorist, it takes only a few days. And we see that so sadly in our country today and elsewhere in the world too. Even teenagers are given weapons and probably given a training of a couple of days and they're ready to go and, you know, perform acts of violence. But if you have to train a soldier, it takes months and months, because a soldier is given the authority to wield a violence, but he needs to be taught self-restraint. He needs to be taught control of himself. And that is why to train a soldier, it takes much, much longer. And that is the legitimate way. If you're giving the authority of violence to a person, that person needs to be trained in self-restraint and trained in self-discipline so much. But that's more of a general topic. I'm just giving that as a disclaimer, that I'm not saying violence is a valid tool all the time. Violence is permitted under certain circumstances, and whenever it is permitted, it needs to be used very, very carefully. That's the point I'm trying to make. The bottom line is, once dharma always takes precedence when it comes to such moral choices. And that's the larger point that we're trying to make here. So when we talk of this question, coming back to the question that Sister Deepa has asked us, is a wife justified in cooking non-vegetarian food for her husband when she herself has given it up, especially because she is a devotee of Swami and that's what Swami expects? On the basis of what Swami says about the dharma of a wife, whatever Swami has spoken about, the dharma that a woman in a family needs to follow, I think, Sister Deepa, it is not wrong. What you're doing is not wrong. And I know people will be ready to pounce on me for saying this, but let me try to explain on the basis of what Swami says. Of course, I have not come across anywhere where Swami speaks of this directly. I'm sure Swami must have in private guided some people who have asked this question, but there's nothing in the in public domain or any private conversation that I could lay my hands on. But on the basis of what Swami says, I think I'll try to explain why I'm saying this. Otherwise, it's quite outrageous to say that it's what you're doing is right. I'll explain that. When it comes to a woman, especially when you're talking about a wife and a mother, one who's playing such roles, the duty that she plays towards her husband and family gains priority over any other approach of morality or spirituality. This is what Swami says. What Swami would refer to as pativratatva, right? That's the Sanskrit word, or being a pativrata, or being, having the nature of being devoted and faithful towards one's husband and family, right? Pativratatva is what Swami refers to as the primary duty of any woman in a family. I know that this approach will be quite unacceptable from the modern point of view. It's quite understandable. It may be considered even retrograde. I may also not be able to explain it logically, because many of Swami's teachings can be explained through logic. You know, you can quote science and you can quote psychology and all of that. But some things are not easily explained using such logical, arguments. This is one of such things. But this is what Swami says. And maybe if I have time towards the end of the program, I'd like to read out a few excerpts from Swami's writings and discourse on this particular topic of the role or the dharma of a woman. For now, let me put it this way, that the question was, will this accrue sin or bad karma in any way, this act of cooking non-vegetarian food? When we are bothered about bad karma, I mean, at least on this show, when you're talking about bad karma or sin, I take it that you're talking of something which will impede our spiritual progress, because we always are concerned about spirituality and spiritual progress on this show. It's not about anything else. So if you're talking about bad karma or sin, I take it that you're talking about anything that will impede our spiritual progress, right? But Swami says that for a wife, there is no other spiritual sadhana necessary at all other than serving one's family and furthering harmony in one's family. So just like how Arjuna was told by Krishna that, look, don't look at what you're going to do as manslaughter, don't look at it as killing your kith and kin. This is your duty as a warrior. When you step into the battlefield, this is the role that you need to play, right? So Arjuna is told that shying away from this responsibility that is at your doorstep is unacceptable, and that is actually a form is an act which will impede your spiritual progress, right? That's what Krishna tells Arjuna. Similarly, I think for a wife, it is not about the act of cooking non-vegetarian food. It becomes performing the duty of a wife. In one of Swami's beautiful vahinis, of course, all Swami's vahinis are beautiful, but this particular vahini, the Dharma vahini, is probably a very, very, it's a beautiful treatise which Swami has written about the various actions, the righteousness of actions that one performs in the various roles that we take up, you know, as a student, as a citizen in the family, in religious gatherings, and all of that. Swami has written so beautifully, and there's one particular, a couple of chapters in Dharma Vahini which speaks about the role of a husband, the role of a wife, the role of a woman in general, right? And in that chapter, I think, as I said, if I have time, I'm going to read out a few excerpts from this chapter. But in this chapter, one thing which Swami says is, you know, there are many nuances of dharma. There are many, many ways of seeing what is righteous action. And they pertain to different life situations and circumstances that one goes through. But none of these dharmas are actually fundamental. They vary from situation to situation. They vary from person to person. And it's very difficult to ascertain what is the right thing to do. But Swami goes on to say that the most fundamental dharma are dharma which pertain to gender, the role of a woman, the role of a man. And that is why when it comes to playing the role of a woman, Swami says that that is one of the most spiritually elevating actions that one can do. So Swami says that, you know, the other details of what is right and what is wrong when it comes to the actions of a woman comes much later, when it striving to be a pativrata is considered superior to any other spiritual observance that a woman can undertake, right? This is what Swami says. So in that context, so if you feel that this way you are serving your husband, and as you say, you do not consume non-vegetarian food yourself, and even when you have to cook, you take Swami's name and you do it, I think what you're doing is not wrong at all. Going back to what Arjuna and Krishna said, the answer does not end there, because what he says is also very, very beautiful. You know, though Krishna is the one who is telling Arjuna to fight, it's important to see the larger picture of the story itself. It's the same Lord Krishna who goes as the peace emissary on the behalf of the Pandavas, right? So the point I'm trying to make is the same Krishna who was asking Arjuna to fight was the same one who was also trying to bring peace in this interaction between Pandavas and the Kauravas, right? So when I apply this to what you're going through, yes, at this point what you're doing is not wrong, but as you are clear that being a vegetarian is a good thing because of what Swami says, I think it also beholds you to keep trying to convince your husband to turn to a vegetarian, right? And as you put it, probably he's not a devotee of Swami, and in fact, he doesn't seem to be very fond of Swami's name. But you can use any other way of using tact because you're convinced. If you're not convinced about that, that's a different thing. Because you're convinced, because you have devotion to Swami, and Swami says that it's better that we all lead a life of vegetarianism. Just as right now, as long as he's not convinced, what you're doing now is not wrong. But it is your duty to keep trying to ensure that at some point he sees the positiveness of being a vegetarian and he quits it himself, right? And that's exactly what Krishna tells Arjuna. He says, look, we've tried our best. You know, we've tried our best to bring peace to the situation. We were ready for all kinds of compromises. But after all that, we are in this situation where we are going to fight this war. So now it is your duty. Now don't turn away from this. And that's why Krishna eventually tells Arjuna, Ma Anusmara Yudhyacha. Keep chanting my name and thinking of me and fight. Right? That's the command that Krishna gives Arjuna. And I think that's what you're doing right now too, from the question that you've asked. When you say, this is my duty, I feel this way, I'll be serving my husband and keeping him happy. And in the process, there's harmony at home too. And doing it, you're doing it by chanting Swami's name and you're doing what needs to be done. That's precisely what Krishna tells Arjuna. Ma Anusmara Yudhyacha, constantly keep contemplating about me and do what needs to be done. So, well, that's that's where my answer actually ends, right? That's precisely what I wanted to say. But since we have quite a lot of time in our hands, I think I'd like to speak a little more about this concept of the nuances of dharma and this idea that dharma is being supreme, especially when it comes to stri dharma or the dharma of a woman. This is very, very interesting story. I'm sure you might be aware of it, and most of our listeners would have heard it. I think we have quoted it a couple of times on our other shows too. It's a story which occurs in the Mahabharata itself, but this is a conversation. This is in the course of a conversation between sage Markandeya and Yudhishthira or Dharmaraja, the elder of the Pandavas. And just for reference, it comes in the Vanaparva of Mahabharata, and it's I think the third book in that series. It's called Markandeya Samasya Parva. That's the name of the book, and this is about a renunciant. His name is Kaushika, and he's a very, very pious renunciant. He's chanting the Vedas, he's studying the Vedas, and he's living a life of a recluse. Once in a while, he goes into the village nearby. He earns his food by seeking alms, and whatever he gets as alms, he eats a part of it, and he also distributes whatever he does not need to the others. Basically, somebody who is leading a very pious life. So the story goes that this renunciant by name Kaushika is sitting under a tree, and he's chanting Vedas, and he's lost in the contemplation. And on one of the branches of that tree is perched a she crane, and that crane, the droppings of that crane fall on the shoulder of this renunciant who's sitting under the tree. And that moment he gets very irritated. He looks at the crane in anger, and he's very upset with that whole scene that he has been caught in. And he looks at the she crane, and the next moment the crane just drops dead. It falls from that perch and it just falls down, and I think it bursts into flames or something like that. And Kaushika himself is surprised to see this scene. And at one point he's feeling that, I did not know that I've attained these powers through my austerities. On the other hand, he's also feeling bad for the bird. He did not intend to harm the bird like that. So he's in a mixed emotion like that. But it's also time for him to go for his alms. So he walks away from that scene. And he goes into this village, and he goes up to this particular house. It's actually a familiar house for him. He has come to that house many times. And he stands at the door and he calls for alms. He says, Bhavati Bhikshan Dehi. He calls for the lady of the house to come and offer him alms for his food. And the lady from inside calls out saying that I'll get the food, please wait outside. And even as she is getting the food and she's getting ready to go and give this alms to this renunciant Kaushika, the story goes that her husband returns after a long trip. He's been out on some errand and he comes back. So the moment the husband comes, the lady of the house, puts aside this food that she was about to give as alms, and she starts serving her husband. She gives him water for him to wash his feet, and she makes him sit down. She offers him food, and she's standing by the side of the husband even as the husband is having food. And for a moment she forgets that there is this person outside waiting for his alms, and she has asked him to wait. And here is the renunciant Kaushika is standing outside the door, and he is beginning to lose his patience. Because he feels that, this is not the appropriate behavior. Because you're always supposed to treat a brahmana, give him highest respect. So he is losing his peace of mind, he's losing his patience. And all of a sudden the woman inside the house, she realizes that she has asked this renunciant to wait for her alms, and she's forgotten about it. So immediately she picks up the food and she comes out, and she sees that the sage is actually angry. You can see the rage on his face. And then she goes on to explain why she was delayed. She says, I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to, belittle you. My husband came and I was serving him and I forgot. But this man does not seem to be pleased by the apology that this woman is giving him. So he starts telling that, is this the way you treat a sage who comes up to your doorstep? And, he says that even the lords respect the brahmanas, even the Indra is supposed, Lord Indra, who is supposed to be the king of all the gods, is said to be one who worships the Brahmanas, and you know he quotes all of these examples, and he says even the king bows down in front of the Brahmana. Is it right on your part to ignore a Brahmana who is standing at your door asking for alms in the name of serving your husband? Isn't this an inappropriate thing to do? And he's very angry when he's saying this. And the lady, who's very, very calm, she goes on to say that, you know, I'm very sorry for doing this. And she goes on to explain that, see, for me, I'm a Pativrata. I am a person who is devoted to the service of my husband. And for me, there is no lord who is greater than him. And when he is there, to serve him is my primary duty, and that's what I was doing. And she goes on to say that I agree that whatever you said about being a Brahmana is right, being a sage, being a renunciant, all of that is right. And she says, but you know, the virtue of a person does not end there. Just being a renunciant, just being someone who has given up the monetary pursuits does not make one noble. And she goes on to explain very, very beautifully the subtleties of virtue. She says it's not so simple. It's not like this is right and that is wrong. And she very beautifully explains why she was not wrong in attending to her husband, even though, you know, we say that to attend to a guest is supposed to be very important, and especially if the guest is a renunciant, a sadhu who's seeking alms, and all of that is there, she says, but still, what I did was not wrong. And then she goes on to say that, you know, what makes a person holy? And very beautifully she explains that it is the control of senses, the control of mind, the one who, you know, who is able to, the quote which I read in the beginning, she goes on to explain something of that sort. She says, one who is able to do good even to those who harm that person, and one who is, you know, not worried about what he gains, but he's always giving, and all of that description she gives. And she says, but look at you, you're not able to control your own rage. And then in very casually she says, and I'm not the she crane that can be burnt by your angry looks. And, you know, this sage Kaushika is taken aback. He says, oh God, how does she know about it? And that moment she makes the reference to that crane which gets burnt. He realizes that she is not an ordinary woman. She is somebody who has really reached an elevated state through her righteous living. So he's surprised when this lady says this to him, and he says, I'm very sorry, I've lost my cool, and you're very right. Whatever you've said is right, and it is of so much benefit to me that whatever you've explained to me. And then this, you know, very pious lady goes on to explain that, you know, you're a very noble person. It is very rare to take up this task, what you've done. You've become a sannyasi, you've renounced the world and all of that. But the nuances of virtue, right and wrong, and dharma is much, much more subtler than what appears to the eye. And she goes on to say that if you're really interested to learn more, you should go to the city of Mithila. And there is a hunter. She says there is one person who is a hunter, and he will be able to tell you more about the nuances of dharma. And after this renunciant thanks this lady profusely and again apologizes for losing his anger. And then he goes away and he tells her that I'll definitely go in search of this person in Mithila. So he goes back home. He contemplates the whole night of what she has told, and he's so impressed by the wisdom which this simple household woman is able to impart. You know, she's not an educated woman in that true sense, but the ability of hers to impart a wisdom which is so profound really thrills this renunciant Kaushika. So he contemplates on that the whole night. The next morning, very early, he starts off. He goes to this city of Mithila in search of this hunter. So he goes around and he asks about this hunter, who is a very wise man, right? I think the terminology which is used in the book is dharma vyada, one who is well versed in the nuances of dharma. So he goes around asking, where is that hunter, or a person who, I think a hunter or a butcher, that's what he says, who is a dharma vyada, who is an expert in the nuances of dharma. So they eventually, you know, indicate to him where he is. He goes there, and when he goes in search of this person, he finds a shop of a butcher, and this butcher is selling meat, which is the deer meat and which is the buffalo meat and all of that. And sitting there with a very peaceful and a very calm countenance is this butcher. And the moment he sees this sadhu who is dressed up in ochre robes and who is looking like a renunciant approaching him, he gets up from his seat and he goes up to him and he greets him and he tells him, you know, I am Dharmavyada, I am the butcher, and I am the one whom the lady sent you to see. And he's surprised by that. And he's surprised that, you know, just like how she seemed to be an omniscient one, this person also seems to be an omniscient one. And then the butcher tells him that, I know that this is not an appropriate place for you to stand and talk. You would find this place very unpleasant. So if it pleases you, please come with me. I'll take you home. And then, you know, this Dharmavyada takes this sage Kaushika or the renunciant Kaushika to his house, and he treats him like how a sadhu has to be treated. He gives him water to wash his feet and offers him food and drink and all of that. And then he goes on to explain, you know, I know this is what you have come here for. You wanted to know about Dharma. And then he goes on to explain about the various aspects of Dharma, what is right, what is wrong, the nuances. And, you know, he goes on to explain the four qualities which qualifies an act as virtuous and righteous. I mean, I'm not going into all of that, but it's a very, very beautiful explanation. And that is why Mahabharata is given a status of the Panchama Veda, because it has such profound wisdom in every small story that is in that book. And this is one of the very, very beautiful stories, and it is narrated to Dharmaraja so that he understands and appreciates the subtleties of Dharma. And so there's this beautiful conversation between this Dharmavyada and the sage, and goes on to explain the various things about how a person is righteous, what one has to do, how one has to act, with what thoughts, and how one is drawn into karma. And very beautiful explanation. Maybe in some other context, if it comes up, I'll speak about that. How he says that, you know, you start off with a virtuous deed, but then there is a desire for the result, and that desire becomes avarice. And that avarice leads to, you know, greed, and greed leads to jealousy, and it becomes a cycle. And then you start doing virtuous deeds because in search of some benefit. And the moment you start doing virtuous deeds with some benefit in mind, they no more remain virtuous deeds. And then he goes on to say how a virtuous deed has to be done purely for the sake of that virtuous deed, which again is the essence of what the Bhagavad Gita says. So all of that he explains. And towards the end, the sadhu asks Dharmavyada, but what about this profession that you're involved in? You know, why are you a butcher? The words that you speak and the profession that you do don't seem to match at all. Why are you still continuing this task? And, you know, then this butcher goes on to explain that he says, look, this is my family business. This is what my father did. This is what my ancestors did. And I was born into this family. And he goes on to explain that we are born into situations. You know, in this case, it's clearly about a family profession. But he says the situations that we are born into or that we are placed into is a result of our past actions. And we need to accept it as it is. And if we have been put in a particular situation, to run away from that situation or to renounce that situation is never the right solution, never the righteous solution that will lead to our spiritual progress. So he says that this is the task I've been given because I'm born in this family. This is my family business. I am just adding to it. And then he goes on to say, but see, even though I'm doing this, I do not, whether it's the killing, the hunting down of animals and birds, or my trading in them, does not accrue any karma for me, because there is no anger in my mind. There is no hatred in my mind. I do not try to make more money than I'm supposed to. I do not try to cheat people. I'm not jealous of others. I'm satisfied with whatever I have. When I have food, I eat. I distribute. I share with everybody I'm supposed to share with. And he goes on to say that is why it does not matter. And the moment you start doing every act as an offering to God, the moment you start doing every act as a means of realizing the Atman, he says that act does not accrue any karma. And that is why even though I'm born a butcher, even though I continue this profession of a butcher, it does not affect me in any way. Well, of course, let me also add the disclaimer that this story and the explanation which Dharmavyada gives this renunciant Kaushika is usually used to justify the eating of non-vegetarian food, because the explanation which he gives is a is a beautiful advertisement for those who wish to eat non-vegetarian food, and about animal sacrifice, and he says how all of this is justified. He gives examples of kings who did charity by killing animals and all of that. He goes into, so if you are thinking that how am I quoting from that, and so is eating non-vegetarian food justified? I think for us, Swami's devotees, there's no question of that. When it comes to us, when we did afternoon satsang on vegetarianism, there's the article also on the website. In the very beginning, this is what we started with. Swami says that I wish my devotees should not eat non-vegetarian food. So I think our command stops there. There is no other explanation that we need for or against it. So for us, Swami says so, so we need to stop. But this particular chapter in the Mahabharata speaks about this, that, you know, you are in a situation, you're supposed to do what you do. And the essence of that particular conversation between this renunciant and that pious woman and this Dharmavyada who is a hunter is both these points I'm trying to make. That violence is not an absolute, non-violence is not an absolute virtue. It always comes with the rider that what is your role and what is your responsibility at that moment. And the other point is the greatness of the quality of a Pativrata, the one who is considering the service of the husband and the family as a primary duty, the kind of spiritual acumen that brings is absolutely unmatched with any other spiritual task one might take up. No, that's the point I'm trying to make. These are the two things which are very, very clear in the story. In the modern context, when we talk about empowerment of women, and progressive ideas of feminism and so on, that is one form of progress in society. I'm not denying that at all, where women are not suppressed and we talk of equal rights of expression. We talk of making it more easier for a woman to, you know, come into a workforce or to raise in the corporate hierarchy and such things. That is definitely one form of progress where we ensure that a woman has the freedom to live the way that she chooses. There's absolutely nothing wrong in that. But when it comes to Swami, the idea of progress is completely different, and that's what we need to be interested in, because that's the whole idea of whatever we do here in the show or on radio itself. What is progress according to Swami? When we are able to move closer to our goal or lead a life of purpose that keeps us on track to reach that goal, that is what is acts which lead to progress, isn't it? So when Swami speaks of progress, for him, I think worldly progress is nothing at all. It's child's play. It's literally child's play. It's like a few children sitting together and playing a game of imagination, right? And saying that you're a king, I'm a minister, or you're a police, I'm the thief. You know, you assign roles like that, and it's like a child's play because the roles keep changing. Today, the children play with the role, they go back home, and tomorrow they come back and the roles get reversed. Typically, that's what happens to the roles and authority that we take up in the world, isn't it? So this game of authority, power, freedom, these are all like that from Swami's point of view. So progress from Swami's point of view, and it should be so for all of us too, is only spiritual progress. So Swami will tell us only on the basis of this idea of progress. So what can ensure spiritual progress is what is the right action to do. So when it comes to women, especially married women, Swami says being a devoted and dutiful wife, serving the husband and family, is far better a means of spiritual progress than doing any form of sadhana or contributing to the workforce or being in a position of influence or authority. It is not that a woman should not take up these roles. I think one will do that as per one's leanings. You know, if one is interested in a certain profession, or one is educated and one wants to make use of that education in a certain form, I think one would do that. But from Swami's point of view, he will always give us what is the shortest route to attain the goal, what is the easiest path for a given person or a given role that one plays. Of course, this idea has certainly been used to oppress women, and what we see today is a course correction of that. It is a backlash of that attempt to oppress women using this particular theory or philosophy. But the very idea that living a life that is devoted to the family or a role of a housewife or whatever you'd like to look at it as. The very idea that living a life like that is a lesser life, an oppressed life, that itself is a fallacy according to Swami. Because Swami says a woman who adheres to her Pativrata Dharma is better than someone who serves the world, better than doing penance or any spiritual activity or participating in any spiritual activity. That means the role of a mother and wife that is played within the house is far, far more exalted and supreme. Because we as a society have forgotten this, because we saw the activities of a woman inside the house as insignificant, today we consider progress as earning more and being in positions of authority and in public life. It's a mistake from all of our point, because we have belittled an act which is so spiritually exalted, because Swami says nothing, you don't have to do anything else. You follow this, it's a royal road to spiritual liberation. That is how profound this role that a mother, a wife plays in the family. It's because we have over generations belittled that. I think what we're seeing is a backlash of that, right? And as Swami would say, dharma never declines, right? Only the practice of dharma declines, which means at any point, if a woman wishes to take up this dharma, it will benefit them. It is not like, oh, this Pativrata dharma or the role of a woman worked in the times of the Mahabharata and Ramayana, not now. Swami says, no, dharma never declines. Anybody who takes up the practice of dharma at any point in time will benefit. Because we have lost faith in that, the practice of dharma has declined. And because the role of a woman plays as a mother and a wife in a family is so exalted, I think these other small errors that occur in the course of doing one's duty, that may happen in the process, like harming of certain pests at home, which we spoke about earlier, and not able to participate in or take part in seva and spiritual gatherings, these are all transmuted because of the exalted nature of the role a woman plays as a mother or a wife or a lady of the house. And as I said, Swami has spoken extensively about this. I'm not saying this off the hat, and you just have to listen to any of Swami's Ladies' Day discourses or the discourses that Swami would give to the students of his Anantapur campus, or the many discourses in the 1960s. Swami would go and address girls' schools in small towns like Bukapatnam and elsewhere. And Swami would go on reiterating this, because everything else is a distraction. Everything else is a longer route to the progress which is really worthwhile, the spiritual progress, right? And as I said, I think I still have a little bit of time. I just want to read a few excerpts from this particular book which Swami has written, the Dharma Vahini, and this particular chapter 4, where Swami speaks about masculine and feminine natures. Yes, I am only picking out a few lines and reading. So if any of you feel that I'm quoting out of context, please go and read that particular chapter. Yes, Swami does speak about the role a husband has to play and what a man has to do in the house also. But you can see that the percentage of emphasis that Swami lays on the dharma of a woman is more here, because that is what is the more valuable lesson that Swami is giving through this chapter. So I'll just read out a couple of paragraphs from that, and I hope it does not need any explanation. Swami goes on to say, women who are the repositories of the embodiment of energy or Shakti Swarupa are in no way inferior. How full of fortitude, patience and love is their nature. Their self-control is seldom equaled by men. They are the exemplars and leaders for men to tread the spiritual path. Pure selfless love is inborn in women. Women who are full of knowledge, who are cultured, who are bound by love, and who are keen on discriminating whether their words and deeds are in conformity with dharma, such women are like Goddess Lakshmi, bringing joy and good fortune to the home. That home where husband and wife are bound together by holy love, where every day both are engaged in reading of books that feed the soul, where the name of the Lord is sung and His glory remembered, that home is really the home of the Lord, Vaikuntha. The woman who is attached to her husband by means of love is indeed a flower radiating rare perfume. She is a precious gem shedding luster into the family. A wife endowed with virtue is really a brilliant jewel. The next paragraph, couple of paragraphs I'm going to read, Professor Kasturi in his translation uses the word chastity. I think chastity is a very narrow word, so I went up to the Telugu version of what Swami has written. The word which Swami uses is pativratatva, right? That is, the pativrata nature is what Swami is referring to. Chastity is a very transmuted, a very limited translation of that particular word. So I'm going to use the word pativratatva itself. So Swami says, pativratatva is the ideal for womankind. By the strength derived from that virtue, they can achieve anything. Savitri was able, through that power, to win back the life of her husband. Anasuya, the wife of sage Atri and the mother of Dattatreya, was able to transform even the Trinity into infants. Pativratatva is the crown jewel of women. That is the virtue for which she has to be most extolled. Its beneficent consequences defy description. It is the very breath of her life. By means of her pativratatva and the power it grants, she can save her husband from calamity. She saves herself by her virtues and wins. She saves herself by her virtues and wins without doubt even heaven through her pativratatva. Women with devotion, faith and humility can lead men on the Godward path and practice of holy virtues. They will get up early, before dawn, clean the home, and after finishing their bath, etc., sit for a while, engaged in repetition of the name and meditation. They will have their homes. They'll have in their homes one small room set apart for the worship of the Lord. There they will place images of the Lord as well as pictures of holy sages and gurus and guides. They will consider the room specially sacred and fill the atmosphere with their prayers both morning and evening, as well as on holy days and festivals. A woman who is steadfast doing these will be able to transmute even her atheist husband, persuading him to join the prayers or engage in some good activity or some scheme of social service marked by the attitude of dedication to the Lord. Indeed, it is the woman who maintains the home, and that is her mission. She is truly the representative of divine energy or Shakti. She who knows the mind of her husband and speaks softly and sweetly is the real friend. Why? Sometimes when the wife has to point out the path of dharma to the husband, she takes on the role even of a father. And when the husband is down with illness, she is the mother. A woman must accord first place to the service of her husband. That is true worship for her. Her prayers, worship and spiritual exercises like puja can wait. Without serving the husband, she cannot attain bliss in worship or meditation. As a matter of fact, the Lord must be welcomed as represented by the husband, and all service rendered to him must be elevated to the level of worship. That is the path of genuine duty. If every act is done as if it is for the sake of the Atma and its merger with the highest Atma, the Paramatma, that activity becomes dedicated to the Lord. All such acts save, they do not bind. It does not matter how bad or low the husband is. Through love, the wife must bring him around, correct him and help him gain the blessing of the Lord. It is not correct to feel that her progress alone matters and that she has no concern in his improvement or uplift. On the other hand, she must feel that the welfare of the husband, the joy of the husband, the wishes of the husband, the salvation of the husband are panacea for her also. Such a woman will automatically receive the grace of the Lord without special effort. Grace will be showered upon her. The Lord will always be by her side and be kind to her in all ways. By her virtue, she will ensure the salvation of her husband. Well, this is the excerpt from the Dharmavahini I wanted to read. I mean, I think Swami is very, very clear. It's not about, that's what I'm saying. The role that a woman plays in the family is so very supreme. The reason why we have looked down upon it is the reason why we are talking of women's progress. is only when, you know, they come into the workforce or when they're able to contribute in that manner. Once again, I'm saying it's not about they should not do that or they need not do that. But the easiest way for spiritual path, according to Swami, and who are we to question Swami's ways? He's the one who has created the path and he's the one who has given the means, and he's saying that this is the best way. Yes, I mean, if our minds are tuned in such a way, if it isn't, you know, wired in such a way that we want to try out different things, that's what we will do. But this is Swami's explanation, which is very, very clear. Before I end, I'll read out another very beautiful excerpt from one of Swami's discourses. This was a discourse which Swami delivered on the 4th of July, 1996. This is a, the sentence-by-sentence translation of that discourse. A very sweet discourse where Swami clearly explains it's not about just doing the duties of the home, but Swami goes on to say how one has to do it, with what attitude and with what running in the mind one has to do that. So I'm going to read out a couple of lines from there. Swami says, many women do their daily household duties and also look after their husband and children. They feel bad that they could not participate in service activities and enjoy satsang. What is the good you do just by joining satsang? To look after the children, maintaining the house, keeping it clean, making the husband happy and leading a healthy life with the family is the correct sadhana or spiritual practice. To cook food and serve the husband and children, to make them ready to go to office and school, and then to do other household duties, all this is considered as a spiritual practice. There is great sadhana in cooking rice. One should feel that to separate the stones from rice and to make it ready for cooking is like Kshetra Kshetrajna Vibhaga Yoga, as to realize the difference between body and the soul. Rice which is to be enjoyed is Kshetrajna, and the stones that are to be thrown off is like the Kshetra. It is like Gunatraya Vibhaga Yoga, to know the difference between the three gunas, and it is akin to distinguishing between the Atma and Anatma. What is to be felt while cutting the vegetables? You should say, I am not only cutting the vegetables, but cutting off my bad qualities with the knife of wisdom. I am putting these cut vegetables in the water of love and cooking them on the fire of discretion. Then I add to it the salt and spice of Shraddha and Bhakti. Then the tasty dish is ready to enjoy. Mothers often roll puri in the evening as a snack for children. While doing so, she need not feel sorry that she is not able to attend bhajans, but has to stay back at home. She should think that she is making her heart broad while rolling puri. While sweeping the house, she should feel that she is cleaning her own heart. To have such good qualities itself is a good sadhana. To stay home and look after everyone in the home is better than to go into a gathering or satsang and listen to something and come back home. To do one's duty in a sacred manner is a very good sadhana, and there is nothing greater than that. That is an excerpt from a discourse that Swami delivered on the 4th of July, 1996. So, yeah, these were general readings that I wanted to share with all of you, but the answer to the question was, as I said, what I gave some time back. I hope whatever I said as an answer to the question and whatever I read after that was useful. I mean, the reason why I wanted to read it out directly from Swami's words is, I know, because this is what Swami has said. This is not what is an individual's opinion or my opinion or what a couple of people think. And if we consider Swami as the one who has created all of this, as we often say, he's the goal and he's the companion and he's the one who's created the path, I think it makes all the sense to go back to Swami's words and see what is the best way to walk this path. And Swami's teachings for all of us, you know, not I today spoke about the role of women, but for all of us as a student, as a citizen in the society, Swami's explanations are very, very clear. And the more we adhere to that, the swifter we will progress on this path. If we slip, if we fall, of course, Swami is always there to guide us further and encourage us and pick us up and give us another chance. But why another chance? When we have the best companion and the best guide to take us to the path. So thank you, Sister Deepa, for that question. It's a very, very important and very interesting question. I hope what I said was helpful. I'll always be happy to clarify further if you need. Thank you, and I hope you found the answer useful. All right then, listeners, it's time for me to wrap up. If you have another question on practical spirituality or anything that you'd like me to discuss on the show, feel free. You can write your questions to prem@radiosaya.org. That's my personal mail ID. So the mails that you send to me will be read only by me. If you wish to be anonymous, you can let me know. I will not mention your name on the show. It would be wonderful if you can send your question in your own voice, like Sister Deepa did, that way I can play your question and then I can answer it. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. And tomorrow, I think, is the beginning of the festival of Ramzan. It's Eid al-Fitr. So all of you who are celebrating Ramzan, and all of you who are not celebrating Ramzan too, a very, very hearty greetings on the occasion of Eid al-Fitr. Let's hope Swami gives us all the focus. As Swami would say, like the crescent is always focused on the star. Let our devotion to Swami be focused like that. Let us always be steadfast in our devotion to Swami. I'm going to leave you with a very beautiful Kavali kind of a song, or it's a very beautiful song sung by our Swami students. On the other side of it, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and Sai Prakash for the last segment of today's Thursday Live, the Vahini Satsang. But I'll join you all again next week, 7:30 p.m. for the next episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth.
اہل طلب آجاب ذکر میں تم کو بلائے احد اللہ ذکر سے بڑھ کے نہیں ہے عمل کوئی ہے فرمان رسول اللہ نجات ملتی ہے ان کو یقیناً کرے جو قلب سے ذکر اللہ ذکر سے سر کٹتا ہے نفس کا بے شک ذکر ہے سیف اللہ ذکر امن ہے ذکر ہے فتح ذکر شفا ہے ذکر ہے دوا
نور محمد صلی اللہ حق لا الہ الا اللہ ہر گل میں ہر بو میں ہر شے میں